Who have we got on the phone? Maybe they're on mute. Yeah.
Hello? Somebody join?
We know you're there.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay, can you announce yourselves?
I'm Julie Gross. I'm calling in from Cedars.
Thank you, Julie.
This is Jonas, also from Cedars.
Okay, hi, Jonas.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, Doug, good. How are you?
Good.
Good.
Is there any way I can mute my line so you can't hear me?
Does your phone have mute on it? Cedar's phone's what they do. By the speakerphone button.
Oh, hands-free mute?
Yes. If you hit that again, it will mute it.
Okay, we're going to get started. We're going to get started because we want to have as much time for discussion as possible. Last time we're meeting together in this group before the end of the year, and what we wanted to do was a little bit of what's happening with PCORI update, and we have some insiders here that might want to join in on what the update is, make sure everyone's ready to write their next grant proposals. Someone else just join us. Can you announce yourself if you came in on the phone? They're on mute. Okay.
I think that was somebody leaving, actually. Who just joined?
Sorry, this is Julie again. I got disconnected.
Oh, there we go. Okay. All right, so first of all, I did want to mention that Erica has now joined Robin on the rapid response team, and so you'll be familiar, and we have, for those who are listening in and not seeing the webinar, pictures of who's supporting you there. Robin, you probably took the slide somewhere near later, but I'll announce it now. We've put out a survey to see who's engaged, who's applying right now for proposals, who wants help, how we can be helpful with PCORI applications, and there is a drawing because we do everything we can to motivate people to participate in surveys. Do you know how many we've had so far? Come in. We just started this last week, and it's about 50 right now.
I think that's about right.
Okay, about 50 of about the 300 people, and we are giving $50 gift cards twice a week. So we'll be announcing the winners of that shortly. But it's not too late for you to sign up if you're not on our web server already, or to conduct the survey. And actually, it was Doug's group that put it together for us, so thank you very much. What we want to talk about now is just briefly what is PCORI's evolving internal structure within the Institute itself, what's going on with the applications for those of you that are in the queue right now, and we had 18 submissions for the first round. There are actually 4 submissions in from UCLA's CTSI on the PCORI pot at the moment. What are the open RFAs, and give you a heads up on the future disease priority areas. Even though PCORI has said it would be disease agnostic, the staff have come up with 25 areas that they like, and 3 of those were discussed at the last Board of Governors meeting, and these will probably be announced towards fall of next year with RFAs that come out at that point in time. But the really meat of the issue today is value of information analysis. Why should you care? What might it entail? And we're calling this starting the discussion because I think it is a discussion that's going to involve all of us in the future, but we're going to need to work our way through it. And Doug Bella has agreed to introduce that topic. Okay, so PCORI right now, they announced their personnel and their openings at the last Board of Governors meetings. They have a division of operations. I'm not going to spend time on who's who in them. They have a division of science. They have a division on engagement. The chief officer on engagement is not there, but this is another indication that they're really serious about patient and stakeholder engagement in the proposals, and they are staffing up to do this. PCORI will be staffing up significantly within the next year because they have decided that all of the contracting work is too expensive. And what I've heard, and Brian may know better, they're going to hire at least 35 additional people and keep their operating costs under 10% at about 8%. Right now they're at 13%. or so. The phase, the proposals that were submitted and are now under review, they reported on a little bit. And they said that they had 481 applications in phase two. 152 of those have been advanced to the second part of the application. And they tell us what the breakdown is. There were actually not very many in addressing disparities, only 70 applications. 26 of those have been advanced. There were more in improving healthcare systems, the comparative effectiveness research, self-identified, of course. And these that went to phase two are being evaluated for impact and then going on to the board for final approval, where they do a little bit of manipulation and balancing what gets funded in terms of geographical spread and disease spread and stakeholder group spread. So I'm showing right now a map of the country, and here you can see the location of the proposals that were advanced. And guess what? We have 22 from California, so we are the leading state in terms of advancement, and we are using politically correct colors here, green, for those that are states that have actually put in proposals that are still in the running. The targeted factors are salience. Is it a common problem? Is it important? Is it feasible to make a valuable contribution within 2 years? Is this an unmet research need that wouldn't be funded otherwise? And they're also interested in resource constraints. Could this leverage existing co-funding? And then there is the third filter, the merit criteria that was set out in the legislation itself, that it is patient-centered. I was invited to participate as a tier two reviewer, but then they didn't have any proposals for me to review, but we underwent training to evaluate on terms of impact. There is a level of improvement criteria, potential for impact on healthcare performance, and the inclusiveness in different populations that they're looking for. So these are, you know, behooves everyone who's interested in applying to take a close look at what are the criteria, because you may have a superb proposal that just doesn't make it because you haven't met all of those marks. The only point I want to bring out on this slide of their November Board of Governors meeting is that they expect to award $300 million in research contracts in the upcoming year, 2013. There was a lot of discussion about the funding that is coming out of the gate too slowly, and that's because of the trust fund and when they're actually seeing the money that they're supposed to be getting from CMS to fund the institute. Okay, and now they are starting what they call the inaugural cycle for opportunity number five, which is improving methods for conducting patient-centered outcome research. They've announced three rounds in which this will be funded, and the LOIs, the first one's due in January, the second in June, and the third in October for applications that they're now giving you, for March, right? That's probably
August.
Yeah, and in December of next year. Now, these are still funding opportunities in the range of $250,000 a year with a maximum of 3 years, and they would love to see the results in a shorter period of time. And they're often saying, we will fund based on prior, you know, continue the funding based on meeting milestones along the way. And they've listed for this one specific questions. So this is a methods proposal, and this is from your methods committee, right?
Not directly. The group that wrote this, which for the most part was separate from the methods committee, reviewed the list of research gaps and methods gaps. I think what would be interesting is to compare this list to the pilot grant RFA and to the grants that were funded under the pilot program, because that gives us some clues as to at least what the reviewers think is important.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And does the methodology committee have anything to do with the review? They throw out the ideas. Do they ever get to? No.
Not at all. In fact, it, you know, in general, it's good news because I discovered over the weekend that I'm actually eligible to apply for these. They've kept us out of the PFA process, the RFA process altogether, mm-hmm. for that very reason. So we don't get involved in reviews, and it's sort of a, it's all done in sort of a public manner. Whatever we said in the methodology report are key gaps. Mm-hmm. The group that writes the PFAs can read just as anyone else can and draw their own conclusions about what they'd like to see.
Thank you for mentioning the methodology report. This report is not out yet. There was a draft circulated. Everyone was invited to comment on the draft. And has that come back to you all, or has that been contracted out to pull it all together in a file?
So the draft was posted in July or June. Public comments were sought beginning in July. We've been using the public comments to revise the standards. Those were revised and approved, so the standards are now out. The responses to the public comments on the report itself, we're still working with, but we took those into account for revising the standards. And the due date for the revised report is uncertain.
Wait, so the revised standards are out?
Those are out, yeah. So the board at this November meeting approved the revised standards. And those should
so
be
they're
posted
online
this part.
So they
should
be. Has anyone seen them?
I haven't seen them.
They haven't been posted. I would have thought they would have been posted as part of the board meeting materials for review, but perhaps not if you can see them then.
Okay.
And know exactly when the PFAs, the funding announcements and instructions, will be revised to require adherence to the standards is also uncertain. Mm-hmm. But it's at least 6 months down the road.
At least 6 months, but when they're out, you're not going to have much time. Right, to spend a lot of time considering them, yeah. And the standards on applying those standards will be high. Okay, so these are, mixed bag, and it doesn't behoove us to go into details because that would take the whole time. But, it's a wide range, methods for patient-centeredness, research in conducting systematic reviews of patient-centered comparative effectiveness research, refinement of general analytic methods, that's a broad one. Development and refinement of design-specific analytic methods are in here. They almost read as if the methodology committee has their interest behind these. The research that determines validity and efficiency of data sources, research on patient-reported outcomes. So it's extremely broad. These are, each of them, extremely broad. Now, they are also get in the cycle three, the third opportunity for applying for funds in the other four areas, addressing disparities, communication and dissemination, improving healthcare systems, and assessment of prevention, diagnostic, and treatment options. And since so many people that, listen in on our discussions are disparities researchers, I just wanted to point out that at the Board of Governors meeting, they made perfectly clear they don't want to hear any more about disparities. They know there are disparities. There's enough research pointing out disparities. They want addressing disparity research. They want projects that are actually going to make a difference. These are $500,000 a year, and they didn't say what the limitation on those durations are. But to date, PCORI has been 2 to 3 year proposals. Okay, here we go. So we have had our first cycle of the survey, and I'm going to need some more time to go through a discussion of this. Maybe we'll postpone that to the next meeting when we get more people having responded. If you are not yet signed up on the Rapid Response Team Comparative Effectiveness Research listserv, and you want to be, we have something in the room. If you're not in the room, send an email to, what's our email address? Just RRT? At MedNet, RRT at MedNet. Okay, this I don't quite understand. Somehow the staff of PCORI has come up with their disease priority areas. We have a list of 25 in front of us that's unreadable because the text is so small, and here are copies of them if you're interested. And these were first put forth with a recommendation. Came together by four science staff reviewing them, two non-science staff reviewing them, independent ranking. They were weighted. They went through a filter. The staff ranked 40 potential topics, came up with 25 that went to the Program Development Committee. And then of those five, They recommended 11, and three of those were actually highlighted at the Board of Governors meetings, and they were on this list, 1, 3, and 5. Treatment of uterine fibroids, management of asthma in African Americans, and prevention of falls in the elderly. They gave more detail about what they're looking for in some additional slides that I won't spend much time going through, but I want you to know we can provide them to you, or you can go to the Board of Governors meetings to see what are these specific questions. For example, uterine fibroids, what is the optimal sequence of therapies, considering women's clinical characteristics and preferences, what are the most important subpopulations to predefine, such as childbearing aim, race, ethnicity, and therapeutic goals, and what do they consider the most important research needs in these three areas. So that, again, was uterine fibroids, severe asthma in African Americans. They say, for example, there remains the question about which subgroups may predispose African Americans to increased rates of adverse events. Is it genetic severity or access to treatment? They're going to be supporting this specifically. And so on with falls in the elderly. So here is the slide where they said their focus is on studies that will inform the choice of the best strategies to eliminate disparities rather than any studies that describe the problem of severities. They're also coming, PCORI is initiating a number of panels in the coming year, and one of them will be on health disparities. It's going to have 15 to 21 members, including patients, caregivers, and advocacy organizations, and I certainly hope that we're going to get representation on this committee from within our organization. So, Doug has very generously, on very short notice, agreed to talk about starting the discussion on value of information. It was a topic that Dr. Meltzer brought up in his visiting talk last week, and the idea is it's something that's going to be expected in future grant proposals. It is desirable to have this. It will replace your impact statement in terms of what will the success be if you are successful with your grant, what's the magnitude of the problem, and that's all I'm going to say to it.
Well, okay. I mean, we can spend some time on this, and then I think there would be a lot of things to discuss. But and Brian, I don't know if you've been involved in these discussions either. But so this was stimulated by David's talk, but then also there was this report that just came out, I guess, about using value of information analysis in patient-centered. You've got the whole. I won't print out the first 7 pages.
It is huge, 50, right? It's exactly
50 pages. It's not huge. I thought I would work through, the example that they give of using value of information analysis, but it's basically using, before I get into the slides, it's using like decision analysis methods to look at, what do we know now and what could we know, like if we had perfect information, and then what's the value of the difference there, and then that's the value, the potential value of doing the research, essentially. To presage where this is going, is it turns out to be very complicated, and also there are a lot of other methodological issues. So the end of this report has a very long list of issues with this that need to be addressed, essentially. And they say, they still end on kind of an optimistic note. I mean, these are decision analysis people, and they say that they'd like to still see a role for this, but it needs a lot more methodologic development is the bottom line. So, but let's just dive in and I'll see what I can do. All right, so they have an example here that I thought we could work through, that we could try to work through, of a disease. It must be something like, let's say it's testicular cancer, but probably in older people, because you want to compare two treatments, treatment A and treatment B, and then the question is going to be what's the value of research to determine which of these treatments is actually better, the value of a study to do that, but the baseline that we know is that the life expectancy if the disease is cured is 20 years, if treatment fails it's 5 years. So I mean, this is kind of a a hokey example, but because I'm not aware of a disease that's really like that, but they're saying the cost of managing a treatment failure is $50,000. These are all the estimates that are going to go into their decision model. The overall complication rate is 20% in one treatment. So in other words, this is like a more toxic, you could think of this like a more toxic chemotherapy. And this is something like a less toxic chemotherapy, 5%. And then you've got a mortality rate of 10% for either one of them. Cost of a complication is $10,000. Cost associated with a fatal complication, $50,000. And notice that the confidence intervals here are quite wide. And they're saying that this is data that was obtained in this hypothetical thing from a case series of 50 patients for treatment A and 100 patients for treatment B. And the data on mortality after a complication is narrower because it was from a different administrative data set of 1,000 patients. So it's kind of like, the idea is you'd be pulling together these estimates from whatever sources you have.
And those estimates are all based on the currently available research. So the reason for conducting the analysis is to determine whether more research would be valuable to narrow the confidence
interval. Precisely. And then I'm going to show you the simulation of how much more valuable really is really the question. I think, was that it for that table, or is there more?
I have one more question.
Yeah, sure.
The analysis also recognizes the possibility that those point estimates can change as well, right? So further research.
Well, see, that's the thing, right. I mean, they could be completely outside these point estimates, and this analysis does not take that into consideration, actually. So that's kind of I think the biggest problem with it, and I just skimming their list of issues, I didn't even see that, but the biggest problem is that you've got to propose this, counterfactual of what might be, the kind of best possible situation, and then compare that with what, you would be doing today. Essentially, that's where it's a little bit. Actually, I wanted to, before I show you these, you guys put the somewhere in here, right? There's the decision tree, right? Okay, so here it's laid out as a decision tree, which how many people are familiar with decision analysis and decision trees? You basically just chart out the possible pathways to the end state. So on treatment A, and this is sort of implied in the data, but treatment A, you can either have a complication or no complication, and then you can survive that complication or die from it, and then go on to be cured or not cured. Or if you don't get a complication, then just cured or not cured. And you start with you start by laying out your decision tree. It's the same shape for treatment B, so it's some other chemotherapy, let's say. Then if you're cured, you have the eventual life expectancy of, 20 years. If you're not cured, 5 years. If you die, zero. You're dead now, so there's zero life from now. And then the same thing for each of these leaf nodes, essentially. And then you multiply back the probabilities along this tree. So, if the survival probability was, just to show you, just to talk through one example, the probability of, if you get a complication of surviving on treatment A was 10%. It was the same in both, so it was 10%. So it would be, I'm sorry, I was talking about, this is the survival probability of this stage. So it would be cure versus no cure, which I guess is, for the first one, would be 94%. So 94% of the time you're going to be cured out here, 6% of the time not, and then you get sort of an average life expectancy at this stage, and then you keep multiplying the probabilities times the value, working all the way back up the tree, so that you get sort of an average life expectancy for this versus this. And if you do that, and we go back up to this, that's too far, here. Yeah. So for this tree, when you work all that out, treatment A has a mean life expectancy of 18.7 years, and treatment B, 18.4 years. So pretty close, but treatment A saves a little bit more life. At at, you know, a little bit more long-term life at the expense of more mortality, more immediate mortality, but more long-term survival. And the net cost is a little bit more expensive for treatment A, you know, like just $300-some. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you divide that, you know, the extra, you know, the 0.3 life years by the $300, it's actually, you know, still a pretty good cost-effectiveness ratio. It's, you know, I think the cost-effectiveness ratio is, they cite is about $700 per quality-adjusted life year. Yeah, $692 per year of life saved. Actually, they don't even talk about quality-adjusted, just per year of life saved. So whether that's a good deal or not depends on what your threshold is for how much is the value of years of life saved. And they take a, so they say that if your threshold is $750 per year of life saved, which is, you know, ridiculously low, but they're just doing it for the sake of this example, then actually treatment B would be superior because, you know, the 692 doesn't meet the criterion for the cost, essentially. But then what you have to do then, so these estimates are based on the middle of the probability range, essentially. You know, we've just taken that midpoint of what we think the of the uncertainty. But then what you can do is you do a simulation to say, you can run a bunch of simulations where instead of picking the midpoint, you like do a random number generator to pick something within the distribution, and you could use, you know, whatever shape distribution you want. You use a Gaussian distribution or something like that. You can run a bunch of simulations and say, well, what are the possibilities if I just pick different sets of estimates for each of those probabilities? And you know, I guess it's mostly the probabilities, not the life years that they were simulating. And so if you do that, you know, you get a bunch of different estimates here, and in some cases, you know, B would be preferred. And also, if your treatment threshold is $750 per life year, you know, in some cases B is preferred, and in some cases A is preferred. So theoretically, you know, if this is, you know, the true value, then you would have picked, and well, or let's say row three is the true set of values, but you were picking B based on just using the averages, then you've had a loss of potential value because you didn't pick the right strategy, but you don't really know that. So what they do though, but then you got to quantify these things. So one thing that you have to do is change everything to dollars, or else change everything to life years. But in this example, they change everything to dollars by taking the life expectancy. If we go back, you know, you take the your willingness to pay threshold of $750. That's $750 per life year. Essentially, you're saying you multiply that by the 18 life years, and that's sort of like a dollar value of all the life years that you're saving, and then you subtract the cost, and then that's the kind of net gain that this treatment strategy is giving you, essentially, if that makes sense. And so when you do that, that's the number that you're seeing here. It's like the net gain of the life year value minus the cost that it took you in each of these different ones. And you can see that it varies a lot because those confidence intervals were pretty wide. Especially around which one was really the complication rate confidence intervals were very wide, and the cure rate confidence intervals were kind of wide, you know, plus or minus like 8 percentage points on the cure rate. So that's why you get such widely varying numbers. But then now, if you want to, now how they do the expected value of perfect information is they say, well, They kind of say if each of these different situations was kind of like, was theoretically the right situation for that patient, or was the right decision for that patient, then the average of all of these that would be, you would pick basically the one of these two, you would have picked the treatment that was best, essentially, and you would, in each of these scenarios, and you would get this as the sort of net benefit of, you know, this would have been the net benefit if you had perfect information. In this situation, you know, this would have been the net benefit because you're picking the lower. Are you picking the lower one or the higher one? You should pick the higher one.
The higher one.
Right. Yeah. So it's going to be the higher one. So then, if you do that, then you average those across all the simulations. This would be the net benefit if you had, you know, picked the right treatment in every case. But since you don't, so this is theoretically the maximum net benefit. But then if you don't, I think what do they do then? But they just say that if instead you were just picking treatment A across the board, you would have this as the net benefit. Although you would have picked treatment B if it was, these come out the same.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's a typo. I think that's probably a typo in that table. Oh yeah, wait a minute, there's something wrong because that table is not the same as this table that I have here. Or maybe, oh yeah, okay, it's just, it was actually, this number is supposed to be 40, these numbers all are right except this one. Is supposed to be 42-14. So the difference between 42-14, if you were just picking treatment B across the board, which is what you would have picked based on just the averages, versus 47-89 is the expected value of perfect information, essentially. That's the way that it's going to work. So they're using each of these different simulations as kind of like the... It's, I guess, trying to come up with an average of the best case scenarios. I think I've seen it done other ways, but that's how they come down to the expected value of perfect information. And then they also talk about an expected value of partial perfect information, which is just taking, instead of varying all of the variables in the simulation at once, they hold one of them constant and vary just the other ones. In the simulation, and so that would tell you the relative benefit of each of the variables. Let's see if we get that chart here. They have a chart in the end where they're looking at how much you would get from knowing, you know, basically just looking at each of the variables in isolation that has a confidence interval, and basically, you know, I mean, it's no surprise that knowing the complication rate gave you the most benefit. I think, or was it the cure? Actually, you know what? And I didn't. Do you have the whole report?
Yes, I do.
Can I just see? There's a graph. And I guess I didn't bring it
right,
either.
And those numbers were wrong on the other table. The B column was wrong.
Right.
It was identical with the total. But if you're doing PCORI, you wouldn't put the
yeah.
values in. They wouldn't want the values because they don't touch money.
Well, I know.
So you would do the number of people. It would be like an attributable.
You could do it. You can convert it all to life years, but then mm-hmm. you've got to convert the value. You've got to convert the cost of the treatment into life years using the same conversion factor, essentially. And then you, I think, because you've
Brian
got to get it all.
Brian is shaking his head. It's your committee.
Fortunately, it's a broad committee with lots of expertise so that some of us can remain blissfully ignorant.
Uh-huh.
Although I'm shaking my head both because it's complicated, but also because the contortions we have to go through because of this cost issue.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
No, I know.
Right.
But yeah, so this graph is where they end up with this, which is the partial information. So basically they're saying that that this top line is cure A, is knowing cure A, essentially. So this would, knowing this number was what gave you the most benefit, essentially. And then knowing this number was what gave you the second most benefit. And then knowing comp A, complication rate, oh, wait a minute. No, I'm sorry. Okay, no, I got it wrong. The cure rate. This is what gave you the most benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Because it applies to more people, probably. And this gave you second most, and then this, and then this, and then this. Gave you very little benefit narrowing this, actually, is what sort of the eventual. So, I mean, ultimately, it makes sense to take some kind of a quantitative approach like this. But, you know, to me the challenge is, you know, what do you really use as your best case scenario,
and is it realistic? But that's actually not even, so what do they talk about? So, well, actually, in the rest of the report, they do review other, you know, instances where this has actually been used. And I guess the UK, the NICE in the UK is where it's been used the most. And there's been some use of government, and actually more non-government studies than government studies had this kind of analysis before it was run. Very few, really. Another issue is patient preferences, is, you know, trying to incorporate patient preferences into this, which is another whole layer of complexity. And let's see, what are the other challenges they talk about? Actually, they've got a whole subsection on dealing with heterogeneity and the challenges there. So specific challenges to use it for PCORI were, wait a minute, I thought they had a bullet list. Cost benefit, well, I don't know. I guess I'm not going to be able to summarize this very well.
Somewhere that we do have the value to PCORI, it's on a slide towards the end.
Oh, really?
Because that's the one where, maybe the very last slide, where they look at every one of the PCORI priorities and how this could help. It's a table.
Yeah. Right. Well, they do point out that it definitely requires a lot of expertise, personnel, time, computing resources. Minimal modeling. Okay, yeah, I hadn't seen that little statement, but that looks like a good statement. This stuff I've already explained for the most part.
Using value of information by PCORI, perform value of information prior to solicitation of research proposals and only requested areas.
Yeah, so in other words, PCORI could do this before they even issue a, theoretically they could have done that for this list of, these top 25, right? But I don't think they did, they could have, theoretically. After initial review of proposals, as part of funding decisions, or research sponsor could encourage or require investigators to include VOI analysis. Right.
And that's what David was talking about. He said, if you want your proposal to shine, yeah.
David
Meltzer.
Right.
That the expectation would be the onus on us to say, here is the value of information.
Yeah. Well, we're actually recruiting this neurologist who's done this some, and he said that actually he put it into an NIH proposal once, a VOI analysis of this diagnostic strategy that he was studying. And it completely befuddled them, and his proposal got trashed because of that specifically. So the study sections may not be so familiar with it.
Business school people would know about this, right? That's
yeah, right, this is based on, right, and I actually was trying to go back to the original. I've got the RAFA book from 1968, and it was, But I was hoping to find a better example in there, but it's completely different domain.
And there's one more table. There is one more table in there where they hold up their...
Yeah, the
maybe all the way at the bottom.
The issues?
There,
yeah.
There it is. Potential use in proposed PCORI evaluation criteria.
I see. So they're mapping their criteria to how... EVPI, okay, across conditions, probability of improvability. So I looked at this. Estimate relative impact of different parameters, right? That's what we're talking about. Differences in subpopulations could be explicitly modeled. It does put everything on a consistent sort of value scale. Impact of reducing health system performance could be incorporated into VOI, right. But that's another layer of complexity too. So in other words, if the health system, if you're gonna layer on to that decision tree, you know, whether the health system is going to actually perform properly, that's another layer of probabilities, essentially, you have to put into the model. So there's challenges, and basically, but you know, it's something that we should be looking at and trying to keep up with, if nothing else. You know, when David Meltzer talked, he said that Anirban Van Basu had written a Stata program.
When we asked him, can we have it on an app? He said, no, we don't have an app, but if you go to this.
He said, I'm surprised Doug hasn't already developed one, but that was a stretch. But yeah, I mean, I guess we could take a look at it, but I'm not sure. Well, we could take a look at it.
So why is it so personnel and resource intensive to do this?
I think you've got to know what you're doing, setting up the decision trees, and then, you know, and running they mentioned the lit searches and, you know, really doing a systematic review for each one of these probabilities that you need to model. And, you know, the confidence intervals. I suppose in some cases it would have been done already. Those were a couple things they mentioned.
And the paper was prepared for PCORI by the Duke Evidence-Based Practice Center, Evan Myers and co-investigators. But I would think if you were planning on putting in a comparative effectiveness proposal, you should have that decision tree in your pocket, right? I mean, what should you be doing studying that unless you've got that all worked out? You may not know the numbers, the probabilities, and the ranges for them, but the tree should be.
It's right. It's always a useful exercise to lay out your decision tree. And sometimes, you know, just thinking that through is one of the most valuable things in doing a decision analysis.
So current health disparities, this should give you the effect of reducing existing disparities. And that effect is not a dollar, because we're not going to talk about dollars. It is the number of lives saved in the different groups.
Or the gap between,
I guess the gap.
The number of lives saved.
Uh-huh. Right.
But it seems like, you know, that adds a lot of complexity to the model, because you need to make lots of assumptions about, you know, the effectiveness of the new information in reducing disparities.
Right.
So if you learn something new about the relative efficacy of the two treatments, and you end up, you know, achieving the same benefit mm-hmm. in both of the groups, the gap remains the same.
That's right.
So, you know, what is it that you know, we learned that allows us to reduce the gap? It seems like that is, you know, it's a separate kind of study.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not assessing the relative effectiveness, but it's assessing something related to the causes, the root causes of those disparities.
Yeah.
The one that scares me is that last one. It will help compare the relative value of different research areas. So how do you win in your research area? You convince them that the value of information gained by your proposal would be greater than someone else's proposal based on not the dollars, but how much you've moved this needle in your confidence intervals?
I guess, to me, intuitively, it's all about confidence intervals. If the comparison between the, you know, sort of leading treatments in one area has a much higher level of uncertainty than between another, then that additional study that, you know, adds to the pooled effect size or the pooled, you know, mm-hmm. sample that allows you to have better precision in the estimates.
Mm-hmm.
You can compare those two.
But you can move a lot and still have a totally irrelevant study in an issue that isn't important, in an indication that isn't.
Right. And that actually gets to the question, Doug, that I wanted to ask, which is, you know, sort of what is the poor person's, you know, approach to doing this? So, you know, I've always learned that in the background and significance section of my proposals, I need mm-hmm. to say something about, you know, incidence and prevalence.
Right.
You know, burden. You know, the you know, again, the precision of the current estimates of the effect size or whatever it is I'm trying to learn. You know, something in some cases about cost. And it seems like those numbers laid out in a simple table would at least give you some of the same intuitive sense of importance that mm-hmm. this more sophisticated analysis would. Is that true? Or is this doing something beyond what I just described?
I think it, you know, what you described would be, it would be the intuitive approach, without sort of multiplying everything out. And, you know, if things are close, multiplying everything out could be very useful, but I don't know how else you, I guess that's the thing is, you know, if you really want to get down to one number, there's, you know, this is the only thing that really makes sense, doing a decision analytic kind of approach. And, you know, it's just a question of how accurate is your model, too. You know, because the real world is more complicated than most decision trees. So decision tree is always a simplification.
So that's what I'm wondering. That clearly, for a lot of reviewers, your approach is going to be much more readily received.
Palatable.
They're not going to throw it out, yeah. But what about proposals which are comparative effectiveness that have, like the uterine fibroids, you know, five different options, or in a different sequence of those options? Can we anywhere get near the modeling needed for that? And what if you want to talk about the value of information of doing the research where there are not even two options at this point in time? You just want to highlight how important that research area is because there is a substantial population, there is not pre-existing attention to health disparities within that area, things like this. Can we do either of those? Is this...
You know, it's just another layer of complexity, I think, but you can do decision trees with five branches. I mean, each branch in the end, you know, you calculate the net value. But but in terms of disparities, right, then you're going to be looking at some intervention, I guess, to try to reduce disparities. Mm-hmm. So that would be an interesting one to think through because it sounds, you know, like there might be a couple of layers you'd have to model.
Unless, comparison is between two, you know, in quotes, treatments for disparities. So, mm-hmm. disparities reduction is, you know, to me, more or less, you know, any form of quality improvement or implementation research, right? The goal is to change practices, and we sometimes evaluate alternative practice change strategies in the same way we evaluate alternative clinical interventions. And if that's what it's all about, then, you know, I don't see it as a, you know, different approach to modeling. You're just focusing on different kinds of interventions.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Jonas, did you want to say something?
No, not everybody else. Just listening.
Will you do it for us? Can we just shop them over to your place?
Will I do what for you?
Our value of information analyses.
Yeah. You could send them over. I'm not sure what you'll get back.
Uh-huh. One other thing I wouldn't mind talking about if we wanted to shift gears, though, a little bit, is the patient involvement. And you know what we've been, mm-hmm. you know, what's our experience with that so far? And have we put in proposals yet that have had patient involvement? And do we have? Because I think we need to set up an infrastructure for that.
Yes, you were just emailing about this. I don't even think Doug knows that you were emailing about the option of having, amongst other things, a panel within UCLA now. One of the areas that they're going to support research is on how well we do this. The research on patient engagement. And I would love to see a proposal. Yeah. And I would love to see a proposal where we actually went into exploring different options. Because they want, you know, ideally they want representative samples.
Of patients. That's interesting.
Yeah, because how can you have a patient reported outcome if you aren't really getting to your patients.
But there was, so even though the revised standards haven't been made public apparently, you know, there was some discussion during the board meeting on standard 4.1.1. That was the engagement standard that generated a lot of controversy.
Oh my goodness, you have them all memorized?
Yeah. Well, 4.1.1, okay. Of the controversy. But the bottom line is that the revision, and the board, you know, agreed with this, sort of steps back a bit in terms of what the requirements are. Hmm. So there's still, you know, encouragement to, you know, engage stakeholders, and it moved from patients to stakeholders based on the argument from Leif Solberg and others that, you know, in some cases it's the clinicians who need to be engaged in order for this to have some, you know, likelihood of having impact. So, you know, patients to stakeholders, but also, you know, engage as appropriate, if feasible, when useful, and so on. A lot of sort of hedging to allow for exceptions. And I don't recall the exact language, but I think the, you know, the requirement will ultimately be a bit looser than what appeared to be the case mm-hmm. based on the July draft. Mm. But I think, you know, the discussion we started by email, you know, thinking through exactly how to make this efficient, you know, for a program like the CTSI, where there mm-hmm. hopefully will be multiple studies with, you know, some overlap of sites or conditions or, you know, patient populations that are affected. I think that's part of what the response should be.
Yeah. Well, right, I mean, I guess randomly sampling patients and just, you know, asking them to participate would be one approach. And it certainly makes things simpler than having to kind of pound the pavement for, like, the best patients who would be most, you know,
representative and informative.
Informative, exactly, right. You know, people who would be sort of activated around, because there are patients who probably would be very activated around participating in this sort of thing, who have some time on their hands and are people who are very, you know, interested in processes, for instance. And you can probably all think of the occasional patient like that, but yeah, it's probably easier to just sample them. And then they're not going to, like, most people are not going to be willing to participate, probably, but if you sample enough, theoretically, but yeah, and then, you know, should we be doing research? Then how do you get the patient input on doing the research to get the patient input? Do we have to do that?
And some of that research might be done by PCORI. So I think the idea mm-hmm. is not to expect the, you know, fund investigators who are conducting their CR studies to simultaneously evaluate their engagement strategies, but over a series of studies, each of which have used different engagement mm-hmm. strategies, there should be some evidence. So. Again, that we'll discuss briefly, but, you know, this large scientific staff that PCORI is recruiting is in part, you know, intended to help out with these kinds of questions. You know, studies that should be done that are, you know, sort of methods-oriented or, you know, PCORI mission-oriented in a way that, you know, sort of rises above the individual studies. But what kind of data might be needed from each of those individual studies in order to have the ability to pool and compare engagement methods is, you know, one of the open questions.
Yeah.
So I would love to see something that compares what you get if you do the panel versus the random sample. You know, and so what would the goal be? Well, sounds like PCORI is really interested in patient-centered outcomes. They want the patients and stakeholders involved in those outcomes. Why not see what would you get as priority outcomes if you did the panel approach versus if you did random sampling versus if you took what physicians thought were the most informative patients? Yeah. And is there consistency across this in terms of, and of course, representation of disadvantaged groups, the unheard voice, making sure it's in the mix.
And I think that kind of idea is within the priority area five.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Those kinds of method studies.
Right.
What are you thinking, Robin? You know, if you go to the map now and you look who's been funded, is he the only one that comes up in California?
Southern California.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's quite a few in the Bay Area. I looked at that too. Uh-huh. Three or four.
So around what the CTSI can do. It's tricky, and because the head of the nurse fellowship and the MPH and is the project director and done a lot of the recruitment around patients. I'd love to hear her thoughts, but also I think we've had some success in getting some engaged patients. It's taken a lot of effort though. And we haven't done it kind of randomly. It's snowball sampling. And
is that right? Yeah. How did you? I know you gave a talk on this, but.
We've been working very closely with the California Primary Care Association, and so we sort of networked initially through them and then really kind of worked hard to sort of drill down within a particular health center if we happened to get through to someone. So there was a lot of interest once we were able to talk to people, but it was often challenging to get to that point to really get through to a patient.
Yeah, because you were going through the providers, obviously.
No. There was really a range. I mean, often it was a CEO or someone who's involved in research for the health center.
And then once you got that person on board, then what?
Then I was able to get a response to an email or get.
But then, how did you select the actual patients?
But they have community members on their board.
So
the health centers. Those are the main people we wanted to
work with.
They had some experience in terms of operational function and health systems, and that's where our target is. And we also did a lot of work with other, kind of referred to other patient advocacy organizations, mostly on the other national organizations. Members and board members.
That's interesting. And you're just taking the patient members off those boards, or are you taking other board members? I guess you're just doing patients, right?
We're doing patients, and then we're doing providers or executives.
Oh, you are, okay.
Staff from the health centers.
Interesting.
See, there are some people saying that if you wanted COPD patients, you could use Epic to identify from the diagnosis and gender and race, but you couldn't actually get their name without IRB approval because you are engaging them, and that's what Tim Carey wanted to put their heads together with us and what's going on with UNC in terms of the challenges there and how they're getting the IRB to support that approach.
We could, that wouldn't be too bad. You know, at the worst, you can go through the providers, but we've done that kind of thing, where we've put out selection criteria, and clinical trials here do that kind of thing all the time. Mm-hmm. Probably it depends. The sensitivity of that kind of outreach depends on how sensitive is the information that you're using in order to identify them. In this case, we could probably propose to send out a letter to a sample of people, maybe with a cover letter from the medical group, we could probably get a waiver to do that, I would guess. So I'm not too worried about that. I mean, it's such a, it's a completely non-risk situation, so there's no talk about minimal risk.
You just wouldn't want to have to IRB each time before you even submit your proposal.
That's true. Yeah. Right. And we'd have to IRB, to even do it at all, we'd have to IRB, And it's still the case that even at the proposal stage, they want to see. Or was what Brian's saying, that mitigating that some. Or maybe that doesn't apply, the board stuff doesn't apply to the current cycle.
It doesn't apply, and it may not, it probably won't apply to the next cycle either.
And as long as they have the stakeholders in the room and the discussions I've been in, they can loosen it. Those stakeholders still have very, very high, they've been encouraged and they have very high expectations.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And I think no matter what, so I guess, my advice would be to, sort of go back to just some of the simple definitions in the mission statement and so on and understand, what's been driving all of this. And if you communicate recognition of those norms and values and explain how you will try to achieve them, even if it's different from what the standards suggest to be done, that's, I assume the reviewers would find that to be responsive and better than a typical proposal.
Yeah.
the very first round, they liked the number of letters you had. The number of letters you had from various stakeholders.
Huh.
All right, well, thank
okay,
you. That
thanks.
Was an interesting discussion.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for jumping in. We're going to continue that, I think, actually tomorrow. And if anyone wants the key due dates for the next round, we've got copies of that here. And, oh yeah, that is mine, unless you want it. No? Do you want to give it to me? Okay. And also this value, it is yours. You want it?
Yeah.
Take it. I think it's just the top. The value of information paper is on their website, but if we can provide that to you, I'd be glad to. And the next group's coming in. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Do this.
I have
page
21.
Oh, okay.
So I have, Seymour, which is the Center for It's our own.
Oh, yeah.
So, which is what I think Lenore and Lenore sort of set up. So we knew about the court moving down pipe to have some structure to be able to respond. Sorry. Oh yeah, we're approaching any time.
Can you help with that?
Robin,
do you know what password?
Just password.
Oh, that's right. I knew it was.